This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Living in a 24-hour society with 24-hour workplaces, 24-hour shopping, and fax machines and email that just won't quit forces most of us to cheat on our sleep. My guest Martin Moore-Eed recommends naps to help catch up on our rest and be more productive. In fact, he's even helped some companies set up nap rooms for employees. Moore-Eed is a physiologist who studies sleep and the biological time clock. He was a professor at the Harvard Medical School for more than 20 years. As the president of Circadian Technologies, he consults to companies that operate 24 hours a day, such as airlines, railroads, factories, and the technology industry. He helps them devise work and sleep schedules that help integrate shift work with workers' biological time clocks. Moore-Eed is the author of the 1993 book, The 24-Hour Society. He says napping can compensate for not getting enough sleep at night because it's actually more efficient than nighttime sleep.
You can catch up a sleep deficit with a nap that's much shorter than the total amount of sleep you've lost. I mean, for example, let's say during the week you've been sleeping about an hour less than you normally would. It might be that just an hour and a half nap at the weekend might sort of reset your base to where you should be. So it can do it pretty rapidly, and that's because it's a more intense form of sleep than the sleep you normally get at night.
Why is it more intense?
It's what you seem to be doing when you fall asleep, particularly with a sleep deficit, is you sort of burn off that sleep debt first. And so it does become quite efficient. Now, as I say, we'll get into different types of naps because it's actually a bit of a different story depending on whether you're dealing with short naps or dealing with long naps. And in the particular case I'm talking about a nap that will be one full sleep cycle or about an hour and a half in length.
Okay, yeah, let's get into the different kinds of naps. The first kind of nap that you talk about is the short nap, 10 to 20 minutes. It's pretty short.
Yes, and there's a very good reason for that, because our natural pattern of sleeping is composed of cycles that are about 90 to 100 minutes in length. And in fact, we progress when you fall asleep, whether it's a nap or whether it's at night, down from light sleep, a stage one sleep, where you're basically half aware of the surroundings around you, down into deeper stages of sleep. It takes about 40, 45 minutes down to get down to those really deep stages of sleep. And then you come back out again, and at night you go through a cycle of dreaming and then go back into the deep sleep again. But the key point about the napping, the short napping, is you don't want to get into those deep stages of sleep, because if you get into that, you wake up groggy, disoriented, in a sort of impaired position compared to where you were before. So the secret of the short cat nap is just to take advantage of that boost you get from the stage one, stage two, the initial stages of sleep, and don't go any further, because you can wake up out of those, be fully alert, and have just taken the edge off, and it would typically give you another 3 hours or so of full level alertness before you might need to do something else.
Now, how does the longer nap function?
Well, the longer nap is truly a method now of correcting for sleep deficit. I mean, the shorter nap doesn't really correct for a sleep deficit you've built up over progressively. And we all get into this stage of cumulative fatigue. You know, by Friday, you're wearing a little thin as compared to earlier in the week, for example, if you've been cheating a little on the edges of your sleep. The longer nap takes you, what you want to do there is you want to go through an incomplete sleep cycle. So typically a longer nap ideally is around 90 minutes or so in length, about an hour and a half. And in that case, what you do is you cycle all the way through those deep stages. You get the benefit of burning off that excess sleep energy very efficiently in that first cycle. And you come back out again at the end of 90 minutes. And if you wake up after 90 minutes, you are coming out of lighter stages of sleep again, and hence you don't get this phenomenon called sleep inertia, which is the technical term for this grogginess, disorientation that one gets if one's right in the middle of the deep stages of sleep.
Do you recommend napping with the alarm set?
Well, if you are concerned, if you're not well trained to wake up spontaneously, many people can do it and sort of do the timing right and so forth. But in fact, we do in fact have encouraged people to have alarms. There are now little special clocks. You can just press a button you can give a nap length, and actually just one push of a button, you can get an alarm timed for in essentially 20-minute intervals.
You've done a lot of laboratory research on sleeping and circadian rhythms. Are we biologically wired for naps?
Yes, we are. It actually is programmed within us. We're programmed, we're biphasic in terms of our sleep and alertness cycles. It comes out particularly clearly in hot tropical climates, and the siesta hour is a well-established practice in many places that have warm locations in the globe. It is a pattern that we have in fact, a sleep propensity. We have two peaks of alertness, one in the morning, one in the evening hours, early evening hours. Which of those peaks is more prominent does depend on your own individual physiology, and there is some real individual physiological differences in all this. So that if you're a morning type person, you have a much stronger morning peak of alertness than if you're an evening type person, for example. But whether you're an evening type or a morning type person, you still have these two peaks of alertness and two times of sleepiness.
The siesta is an accepted custom in a lot of countries, as you mentioned, particularly tropical ones. Though what we always hear is that, well, that's because before air conditioning it was so hot nobody could possibly work in the afternoon, and that's why they slept. But if you take a nap here, you're going to be considered lazy.
Well, yes, it's very much part of our Puritan culture to view the taking of naps as a slothful activity. And indeed, that's what really impedes very much the practice of napping. It's done guiltily and secretly, typically. But in fact, more and more enlightened workplaces, particularly those where they're asking people to work extended hours, to be at peak levels of creativity and performance, are recognizing there's a trade-off. If you want a high-performance workplace with flexible hours in terms of work, the trade-off, the fair trade-off, is flexible hours in terms of sleep. In other words, companies, I mean, we do it ourselves, have napping rooms. So we have a napping room that people use, and we encourage the use of that. Now, we don't expect someone to come in late and leave early and then use the napping room in the middle of the day. That obviously would be an abuse of it. But we expect people to sometimes have to work late or sometimes have to come in very early to get the job done. The fair trade is to allow some way to give them boosts in terms of their performance and alertness, and the fair way is to allow a napping policy.
So have you worked with companies who have set up nap rooms for their employees?
Yes, we have. We've set up policies and nap rooms and helped them design those facilities, helped them look for ways to typically with reclining chairs, lazy boy type chairs and so forth in them, dim lighting with a phone hookup that's not a audible phone but a vibration so people can be called or summoned if needed. Yes, absolutely. And that is that's occurring more and more.
What's your company's nap room like?
Well, what we have is actually, we use it experimentally. We have some high-tech Japanese napping chairs.
Well, describe them for us.
Oh, yeah. Well, they're rather cute. They actually, this is where you have the whole napping experience, the push of a button, a chair, you press a button and it goes through an automatic recline. It gives a certain tuned vibration at the back of the spine, which actually is proven to decrease the time before you fall asleep. And then it times the nap at the end of it. It shines bright light and blows cool air in your face, and it brings you upright and has you ready to go again. So it's a wonderful technology, and we're still in the proving stages. I mean, one of the little challenges is that the average American is about a foot higher than the average Japanese, at least the chair was built for. So there are a few little things we're sorting out along the way, but no, we typically have the latest technology that we're playing with and working with.
Now, I would imagine that when you're consulting to a company and you're recommending a nap room and a nap policy, that the company is afraid that the nap room will be taken advantage of, that people will be just kind of going off there and sleeping longer than they ought to be and using the nap to avoid work. What are the concerns that companies bring to you, and how do you address them?
The first, the sort of issues that you want to make sure that you're addressing is there a sort of a reasonable control checking policy, a way of knowing that your people are being reasonable and the issue isn't being abused? And so one of the concerns, obviously, is someone's going to cut, play hard at night, party all night or whatever, and come in and sleep it off during the daytime. That's not a fair trade, obviously. And so the real issue comes down to more the output. In other words, is the person performing the job you want them to perform? Are they being offering the creativity and energy and accomplishments you want to see them achieve? And if they are, then allowing them this policy enables you to get around that.
My guest is physiologist Martin Moore-Ead, the president of Circadian Technologies. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Martin Moore-Ead, and he's the CEO and president of Circadian Technologies and author of The 24-Hour Society. You know, the expression asleep at the wheel, we use that as a metaphor, but it's something that actually happens to a lot of people. You're driving and your eyes just kind of momentarily close and you say, oh my God, I'm falling asleep, and you wake yourself up. But in those few seconds that your eyes close, it's terrifying when you realize the potential
And sometimes you don't wake up early enough. And that's the issue, because in fact the largest cause of fatalities on the highways these days is not drunken driver accidents; it's actually fatigue-related accidents. Now, the phenomenon you're referring to is called microsleeping. It's these short interludes of sleep. Sometimes they happen without you even realizing it at all. And you can go in and out of these things and have a 10 second or a 20 second lapse. Now, if the road's straight and there's no traffic in the way, you can get away with it and come outside. You might drift outside your lane. But if it's unfortunate enough for the road to be taking a bend at that point in time, you'll come off the road, or if there's a stalled vehicle, you'll hit it without even tapping the brakes. It's a major cause of accidents and deaths on the highway, particularly cause of fatal accidents, because the difference between someone who has an accident because they're fatigued, because they have a microsleep, versus someone who's drunk or alcohol or just not paying attention, is that in most situations, you will react to some extent, and you will avert the full impact of the injury. Whereas you've got in the middle of a microsleep, you will not touch the brake, you will not make any steering correction, and you'll hit the hard obstacle head on. And hence that the proportion, there's some estimates that suggest as many as half the fatal accidents on freeways, on rural freeways, are due to fatigue-related microsleep accidents. Now, it may only be 5 or 10% of the total number of accidents, but it's half of the fatal ones.
If you're having these little microsleeps, is that a pretty good indication that you're sleep-starved?
Yes, it is. It's an indication that you're leaking sleep, as it were, out of your conscious, in the middle of your conscious day. It is something that's going to occur more prominently at certain times. The biggest time of risk is in the wee hours of the morning. One of the most dangerous things you can do is decide to take advantage of the quieter freeways at night and decide to drive to your vacation overnight. Because if you stay up and then drive by about 3, 4, 5 in the morning, people get in very dangerous states, and that, in fact, is the peak time of accidents. In fact, truck drivers have 15 times more accidents at 5 o'clock in the morning than they do in the middle of the day, for example. And the same sort of pattern's true for any type of driver. So those microsleeps are going to occur at that time. They're going to occur in the post-lunch siesta hour, as it were. But they are an indication. If you are microsleeping, you really shouldn't be on the job, or you shouldn't be performing the activity.
Oh, one more thing about microsleeps. You know that feeling where this microsleep is coming on and then you're trying to fight it, and then it comes on and you try to fight it again? It's a really irritating area to be in, you know? Anyway, so what suggestions do you have if you can't take a nap at that moment? What suggestions do you have to get yourself out of that netherworld and wake yourself up?
Well, it depends what you're doing, because clearly you are in. If you're in danger, you really should be pulling off the road and trying to find an opportunity to take a break. Ideally, to take a nap break if it's safe to do that, or a coffee break, or stretch. The problem is some of the short-term things, like just getting out and walking around and so forth, will sort of protect you for the next 20 minutes, but you'll be lapsing back into it pretty soon again. It doesn't give any long-term benefit. But the things that people do, we've all tried them. Turn up the air conditioning, turn on the radio, and you find one of these particularly irritating talk shows, not this one, of course, but maybe one that's really, really interesting to you, but something that keeps your mind alive. There are even devices that people use, using aroma-based devices that can keep people awake. There's a whole technology developed in Japan to do that. That pattern is a warning signal, and the best thing is to break out of what you're doing. Now, if you're in a meeting, find an excuse to go out, get up, and walk down the corridor. Find an excuse to sort of get a bit of cool air, because it is very tough. Because one of the problems is this: when you're in that microsleeping situation, you're aware you're getting into it often, but you don't have conscious control of what happens. So in other words, you can naturally just come back out of your microsleep and it was just a brief moment, but you can also just inadvertently slip into deeper sleep and you don't have conscious control of which way you're going. And this is the biggest danger when driving or in a critical situation. People think they've got this mastered, think, well, I'm just going to sort of, I'll get through this. But then it's very hard to distinguish between your mind is wandering suddenly, and then suddenly you found you've actually come off the road or totally fallen asleep. And you can't tell the difference. You lose that judgment.
Getting back to napping, do you have to be careful that your nap doesn't interfere with a good night's sleep instead of supplementing your night's sleep? Mm-hmm.
Well, I think that's classically been one of the concerns that have been raised. I think it tends to be, quite frankly, much more likely that people are relatively sleep deprived. And if you're at all sleep deprived, then a nap will help you. Now, it's true that if you spend all your time napping, and particularly if you nap close to bedtime, then you will interfere with sleep. But there's some interesting things here. For example, what happens when you get particularly sleep deprived is it actually is a stressor. We know it's a stressor from all sorts of reasons. It impairs the immune system. It has all the symptoms of cardiovascular and other symptoms of stress that build up as someone gets more and more sleep deprived. And the trouble is, sometimes in that situation, you can't sleep well at night for whatever reason. Some things to do with your biological clock, some things to do with your own sleep personality. But essentially, one way you can actually break that cycle is have a nap in the afternoon, which will just sort of take off that sharp edge of fatigue. And then, interestingly enough, you'll find yourself sleeping even more the next night. In other words, suddenly you won't be waking up sort of short of sleep or in an insomniac state.
I guess the value of napping depends in part on whether you're not getting enough sleep because you have insomnia, or you're not getting enough sleep because your work doesn't allow you to be in bed long enough to get enough sleep.
Yes, I mean there's a host of reasons and situations. I mean, there are many, many causes of insomnia. Some of them are medical causes, some of the psychological and stress-related causes. All those factors. It also is a function very much of your sleep personality. I have a new book coming out in the fall, which is going to be really classifying people's sleep personality, rather like a Myers-Briggs test, in four scales. And based on that, you can actually devise a strategy that's very effective for you personally. So that, for example, you will have a scale to do with your morningness or eveningness. In other words, are you an extreme morning person, or are you an evening person? I'm a morning person. I get up 4 o'clock every morning. I'm a social zombie, as my wife will frequently tell me, by 9 or 10 at night. There are other people whose motor doesn't get running till noon, but they're going great guns at 1 a.m. Now, that's one scale. Another scale is your rigidity pattern, your flexibility rigidity. Some people can sleep at all hours very flexibly, move their sleep times around. Others find that they wake up at exactly the same time, whether they want to or not, weekends, weekdays, and so forth, very rigid cycle. Third pattern is your sleep length. Some people are naturally short sleepers, some are long sleepers. Some do perfectly well on 5 hours sleep a night, others need 10. And many people, of course, most people are somewhere in between. And then the fourth scale is your napability. Some people find it very easy to take naps. Others couldn't nap if their life depended on it. So you need to understand that sleep personality to really tailor your own strategies for coping. And so, you know, when we give advice for something like napping, it does depend somewhat on your own napability. Now, you can teach some of it, but there are some people, even with all the teaching in the world, are not really very good or very spontaneous nappers.
Martin Moore-Ead is the president of Circadian Technologies and author of The 24-Hour Society. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Martin Moore-Ead, a physiologist who studies sleep and the human biological time clock. His company, Circadian Technologies, consults with companies that operate around the clock, requiring many workers to work during the night and sleep during the day. Our biological system is geared to sleep at night, but the work world does not always accommodate human physiology. I asked Moore-Ead if people who have to sleep during the day must fool their biological time clocks.
Well, yes, whether one uses the pejorative word fool or whether one uses sort of taking advantage of scientific knowledge, but certainly you have to recognize that reality. Now, there's nothing intrinsically impossible about shifting your time of sleep and alertness. It is actually, we understand a lot about the levers of that. After all, if you went and flew across the Atlantic and went to work in Paris for a while, you would be working at on a different time zone and a different schedule, and you would be feeling perfectly well adapted to that. And you've got to study what are the differences. Well, one of the key differences is the timing of exposure to light and dark. And in fact, if you can control light and dark, it's the single biggest cue that determines where our own biological clock in the brain lands up. So that, for example, if I were to put you on the night shift and make your exposure to light be similar or in a similar range to the daytime, and then when you're sleeping at home, make sure that it's totally pitch dark, your biological clock will totally adapt and you will feel no different during the night hours of work than you would during the day hours of work previously. Now, that's very well if you've got people working in a very controlled environment. I mean, you can do it easily on a Navy submarine or on an oil rig platform where you've got total control. Of course, the missing factor is the social life of one's family and friends. And that's where people really get deeply into trouble because that's where they try to burn at both ends and try to adapt their wake and sleep patterns to their family life. And then they try to adapt. Also, they're trying to make a compromise with the work life. And that's typically where the whole thing comes falling apart.
When you talk about how you can set your biological clock with your use of light and dark, does the light have to be sunlight, daylight, or can it just be electric lights?
It can be electric light. It has to be sufficient intensity of light to have an effect. We know that although you can have some levels of resetting of light with dimmer levels of light, in fact, over a number of consecutive days. So that, in other words, if you keep on getting up at 5 in the morning and turn the room lights on week after week, you will adjust to that spontaneously. Using bright light of at least 2,500 lux, which is a unit of measurement. I mean, give you a feeling of the scale here. If in a typical office situation, people are typically working somewhere between 200 and 400 lux. When you walk outside under a bright sunny day, it may be 50,000 lux. It may be 100,000 lux in the beach. And when you go into a movie theater, you're probably dealing with about 2 or 3 lux of light. Now, many people do jobs like your aircraft pilot does his job in movie levels of light, which is a sort of a scary thought in itself. That level of light that is similar to a cloudy day outside which is in the range between 5 and 10,000 lux, is very effective at shifting the clock. You don't literally need sunlight to do it, but you need daylight levels of light.
Where is our so-called biological clock?
Well, there is a key central biological clock, which is called the suprachiasmatic nucleus, or SCN for short, which is located in the hypothalamus, which is one of the older parts of the brain. It's actually located back behind the eyes. It's called suprachiasmatic because supra from the Latin meaning above and chiasmatic meaning above the optic chiasm, and that's the place where the main optic nerves cross over as they go back towards the occipital cortex, the back of the brain. And at that point, we've got these two little cluster of nerve cells. They're about 10,000 nerve cells, but it's very small. It's about a third of a millimeter in size. And this biological clock acts as the central pacemaker that governs the timing of our lives.
And how does it do that, or is that too technical?
Well, we can take the first level shot at it. What it does is it actually, it itself can sustain time all by itself. In other words, we could take it out into a petri dish, and it will mark time in the petri dish. We can transplant it back into another animal, and we will translate knowledge of time of the donor back into the animal. So its literal is like a little microchip, as it were, which operates on its own. So that's a very first important thing. It spontaneously runs at about a 25, in humans, about a 25-hour pattern. In mice, it happens to be closer to 23. So it's different species to species. That clock is reset each day by light, particularly at dawn. In other words, you get this little corrective stimulus, bright light falling on the retina at dawn, traverses up and hits this biological clock at a time when it's sensitive to what are called phase advances or shifts earlier in time. And so what it does is it pushes the clock back into sync again. It's rather like a wristwatch, which is running at 25 hours and you reset it every morning when you wake up. Now, that clock, in turn, drives all sorts of hormonal and neural signals going up to the pineal gland, which controls melatonin and a hormone that promotes sleep. It triggers into various parts of the endocrine axis of the body, and that, in turn, sends signals out to every cell. So it really is the conductor of the orchestra. It's making sure that all the different rhythms of the body are all kept in sync with each other, which is a key part in terms of your normal health and in terms of your ability to stay synchronized with the environment.
You would like to see more hotels that cater to international travelers who are changing time zones all the time. You'd like to see these hotels be better equipped to help the international traveler sleep. What would you like to see?
Well, one of the classic things in a hotel room is that, particularly if you want to sleep outside the hours that are traditional for that society in that time zone. In other words, you've just flown over into a new time zone. You're just going to be there a short period of time. You want to stay on home base time as opposed to local time zone. Is you want total control over light, dark, quiet disturbances and so forth. So you want a light, totally light type room. You want to be able to get pitch darkness at any hour of day or night. You want to make sure that sounds are controlled, that it's sort of adequately soundproofed. You'd like access to lighting systems or bright light visors or other techniques that can help reset the biological clock if you so choose. And you want the services of the hotel to be oriented in that direction. In other words, you want to have 24-hour room service available. In other words, so you can decide to eat dinner at 5 o'clock in the morning if that suits you. You also want to make sure that the hotel maintenance staff and the people who clean the rooms are savvy to what schedule you are on, so they don't come barging in the middle of sleep and wanting to vacuum out the room or whatever. So it is something we're starting to see happening, and indeed, many hotels are not very good in this direction at all, but we're starting to see this, and it really is a requisite to be able to work and live reliably, particularly for the business traveler who these days with a global economy is having to jump around the globe and often land in a city in a faraway time zone for a very short space of time before moving on.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us. Thank you.
It's been a pleasure.
Dr. Martin Moore-Ead is the president of Circadian Technologies and author of The 24-Hour Society. His next book, The Idiot's Guide to Getting a Good Night's Sleep, will be published in September.